Okay, so this is the title that was given to me by the organizers. I think many of us were somewhat, had to think a bit about what they intended us to really talk about, and I'm going to interpret this rather broadly, but what I'm mainly going to focus on is some of the effects that galaxy interactions and mergers can have, especially in the high redshift universe. So as we've been hearing during this meeting, galaxy interactions and mergers, particularly major mergers, may well be responsible for morphological transformation from disk-type galaxies to spheroids. They may trigger gas inflows, which could feed central black holes and fuel AGN. They may also trigger massive starbursts, and there's a lot of strong evidence, which we heard about this morning, that this process is actually at work in the local luminous and ultraluminous IR galaxies. And perhaps the same process is also fueling the high redshift Lyman-Break galaxies and perhaps the submillimeter sources at high redshift that we heard about from Amy. So perhaps the best way to study this process in detail is using SPH simulations, where you take two individual galaxies and you put them on collision course and just run them together. So basically, cosmological simulations simply don't have the resolution to really resolve this process properly. So a lot of the pioneering work on this was done by Niehaus and Hernquist and also Barnes and Hernquist using this technique. And here you see a sort of generic sequence. You see the two galaxies here. These are stable disk galaxies, which are set up to resemble the Milky Way galaxy in their size, mass, and circular velocity. Here you see them on their first close approach. Here you see the strong tidal tails that are elicited. Here they're sort of on their first pair of passage. And here's the final merger and relaxation into an object which, as Lars discussed, can look at least vaguely like an elliptical galaxy. Now there's also a response that happens if you add star formation to these simulations. So what Niehaus and Hernquist did is they simply assumed a Schmidt law for the star formation. So the star formation density was modeled as being proportional to the gas density to the 1.5 power. And then you can calculate a star formation rate as a function of time during this merger event. And what they found in major mergers was this sort of behavior when you run two pure disks with dark matter halos together. That's this blue curve. So you see this rather broad and lower sort of peak, which occurs during this phase of the merger. Then you see the star formation settle down again, and then you see a second smaller peak, which occurs during the final merger event. You see a rather different behavior if there's a massive bulge. This is a bulge which had one-third of the mass of the disk, pre-existing bulge in the galaxy. In that case, the first peak is suppressed, and you see a second, much stronger peak during the final merger. This behavior was found to be quite robust to different geometries, whether it's prograde, prograde, retrograde, prograde, etc., and different inclination angles, etc. However, in minor mergers, this is a case where they simulated a small satellite galaxy being accreted by a Milky Way galaxy. You see only this single broader peak. This is in the bulgeless model. And where you have a bulge, this peak is actually suppressed altogether. And this is because the presence of the bulge actually stabilizes the galaxy against the inflows that produce the starburst. So this work definitely highlighted some of the important details of this process, but as has already sort of been alluded to, the disk galaxies that probably form present-day ellipticals, even if this merger picture is correct, do not resemble the Milky Way. They probably resemble something rather different. And so you might want to worry about that. And similarly, if you want to try to relate these two high redshift Lyman-Break galaxies, you might worry that the initial conditions that were used in these simulations might not be appropriate. So what we've done, the group based in Santa Cruz in Jerusalem, is we've used the same code as Niehaus and Hernquist, the Hernquist and Katz 3SPH code with the Schmidt law star formation, and we've repeated their experiment but using initial conditions for our disk galaxies that we believe to be more appropriate for a high redshift Lyman Break type of galaxy. So the galaxy is about a factor of five smaller in mass. It has a higher gas fraction. We've simulated a gas fraction of 0.5 and 0.9 as opposed to the gas fraction of a tenth that was simulated by Mihos and Hernquist. And the galaxy also has a much smaller scale length. This was chosen to match the observations of the optical scale lengths, although it has a similar maximum velocity. And the other properties of the galaxy were, for the most part, similar to those chosen by Mihos and Hernquist. So this is the star formation rate now in one of these high redshift galaxy mergers. And I just want to go through again sort of the correspondence between the star formation response and the dynamical phase in the merger. So here are the two galaxies. They're hanging out. They're happy. And this is the first closest approach. So here's where they first sort of pass through one another. So you don't see very much response. And what I want you to notice that is that several dynamical times at the half-light radius elapse before you see a strong response in the star formation. So the galaxies have actually passed through one another and started to separate again by the time you see this peak. And then this second peak, this is similar to the same peak that you saw in the Mihos and Hernquist simulations, happens when you've already formed a rather compact merger remnant. So another thing we'd like to study is how sensitive these results are to things like the gas fraction. Here I'm showing the star formation curves for the Mihos and Hernquist type simulation, which we've repeated here. This is a gas fraction of a tenth. Here I've scaled the time in the simulation unit so that it would be more comparable to the high redshift case. Okay, so I've just scaled it by the same factor. So you see that by the blue curve. This pink curve is now a case with a gas fraction of a half, and the red curve is a gas fraction of 90%. So this disk was 90% gas before the merger. So you see considerably higher star formation rates. But on the whole, you see qualitatively rather similar behavior. So the details of the temporal behavior of the two peaks, et cetera, may differ, the relative strength of the two peaks, et cetera, but the overall behavior seems qualitatively similar. Another thing that turns out to be quite important, not too surprisingly, is the mass of the halo that we choose to place around this disk. So in the Mihos and Hernquist simulations, the mass of the halo within a Gaussian cutoff of about 10 scale lengths was 5.8 times the mass of the disk. It's again the blue curve. Now, in the high redshift simulation, we chose to put a more massive halo around our galaxy. And that was basically to match the expectations that we had from the hierarchical clustering models. So we decided to look at what would happen if we placed a smaller halo, more similar to the case done by Mihos and Hernquist, and that's shown by this green curve. So you see that this first peak now is stronger. You don't have as big a halo stabilizing the galaxy. But again, the overall amplitude and the qualitative behavior is still similar. We've also simulated several different mass ratios. So those were all one-to-one mergers. Here's the same one-to-one merger again. Here's another case which has a mass ratio of 1:4 and 1:10. So you see, even with a 1:10 merger, you get a considerable response here in the star formation rate. Now, these have all been absolute star formation rates, which of course depend on the amount of cold gas, the absolute mass of cold gas that was present. So you might like to scale this somehow in some way that you could apply as a more general recipe. So that's what I've tried to do here. This is what I call a scaled efficiency, which is the instantaneous star formation rate over the mass of cold gas that's actually present in the system at that time. So it takes into account the gas that's already been consumed by the burst. And I've just plotted all of the cases on top of one another here. And the point I'm trying to make here is that this scaled efficiency, in some time averaged way, is rather similar for all of these cases. So even the very minor mergers, although they don't reach the peak efficiencies for as long a time, do reach similar levels of increased star formation efficiency. Another way of seeing that is just to look at how much gas is consumed as a function of time. So this just shows the fraction of gas remaining as a fraction of the initial gas, again, for all of the cases that I showed you. And what you see is that, rather generically, you consume about between 60 and 80% of the gas over the course of the burst in all of these cases. So another thing you might be interested in is, suppose that we looked at one of these galaxies at redshift 3, what would we actually observe? So I have the whole star formation history, so I can simply convolve it with a stellar population model, such as Boussole and Charlot, which is what I've used here. And I can plot its magnitude in any bands that you like. So here's a bunch of bands from NICMOS and WISPIC. And the top curves are without any dust obscuration. So you can see that this galaxy, which remember has a circular velocity of about 200 kilometers per second, would have reached magnitudes of about 24th to 24th and a half magnitude. This is without any dust. If I put in a factor of 5 dust extinction at 1600 angstroms and use a Calzetti absorption law, the factor of 5 comes from the favorite value, at least a few months ago, of Seidelidol. Then you see these dotted lines. So you see that this galaxy would be visible above the sort of spectroscopic detection limits for on the order of a couple of hundred mega years, even with this level of dust extinction. So you then might like to ask, well, this is all fine, but what global implications does this have? And in order to do this, of course, we can't use these simulations alone. Yes, it does. In fact, we used Rob's scaling law to choose the normalization of our Schmidt law in the simulation. So it has to start on the Kennicott law. And in some sense, it's not surprising that it stays on the Kennicott law because we've basically chosen the constant to agree. And you do see some scatter, of course. Sorry? Can I defer that question, please? Okay, so what I want to talk about now is basically what happens if you take this simple recipe, this efficiency as a function of time that we've learned from these simulations, and you apply it within a semi-analytic model where you have a whole merging history and you have some idea what's happening with the cooling of gas, etc. So what I'm showing here is the star formation rate in a single Milky Way type galaxy here in a scenario where all of the star formation is quiescent. So the star formation is basically constant quite far into the past. In the second panel, I show a case where I've put a starburst only in major mergers. So this sort of corresponds to a classical picture where about 12 gigayears ago, you have a major merger, you form a spheroid, and then subsequently, you form stars quietly and you make a disk. Here, all of these little minor bursts are allowed to have starbursts as well. And the minor bursts are much more frequent than these major mergers. And remember, they don't form spheroids. They might thicken the disk a bit, hopefully not too much, but they do produce these starbursts. So what does that do to the actual number of bright galaxies that you would observe? It turns out that it changes it quite dramatically. So this shows the co-moving number density of galaxies brighter than 25.5 at rest 1500 angstroms as a function of redshift. And these points up here are from observations of the Hubble Deep Field. This is from the Lyman-Break technique. These are from photometric redshifts. The solid squares are from Seidel et al. 1999 from their spectroscopic sample. So in the quiescent model that's shown by this green line, you have a strong decrease with redshift in the number of bright galaxies. That's not surprising because in this model, these bright galaxies have to live in massive halos. The number density of massive halos is decreasing strongly with redshift. In the starburst models, which is shown by these curves, by the pink curve, you have these small objects that are popping up and becoming visible. And so you get a much flatter dependence with redshift. So these top lines, in all of the cases, have no dust extinction. And the bottom bold lines have dust extinction using a model that's been tuned, again, to agree with the favorite results of Seidel et al., 1999, and Adelberg and Seidel. Here you can see the effects of dust in a little more detail. This shows the luminosity function at Z of 3. So these red points are the actual observed luminosity function of Lyman-Bright galaxies on the bright end from, again, Seidel et al., on the faint end, joined on with the Hubble Deep Field. And these open blue points are from Adelberger and Seidel, where they've corrected each galaxy for dust extinction using the far UV spectral slope beta, the technique that we've heard about earlier in the meeting. And what you can see is that the unextinguished luminosity function from the burst models shows the same sort of tail, shows this much flatter shape than a Schechter function. When we include a differential dust extinction model where the brightest, most actively star-forming galaxies are the most extinguished, that brings the models into good agreement with the actual observed luminosity function. Conversely, if you had a model where the star formation is quiescent and the luminosity is tracing the mass tightly, again, the halo mass function is falling steeply here. So the luminosity function without any dust is already falling steeply. And if you put in a differential dust extinction model, that, of course, makes it fall off even more steeply. And it, of course, doesn't look anything like this kind of behavior. You see a similar sort of thing at Z of 4. And I should also mention that, of course, the other side of this coin is that all of this light is going into dust. These magnitudes correspond to many hundreds of solar masses per year of star formation. These are the SCUBA sources. So if you add all of this up, you can make a Mendel plot. And the data here, these squares, this square is from Treyer et al., this is from Cowie et al., these two are from Seidel et al. So these are all in rest, sort of 1,600 to 2,000 angstroms, and I've made the same correction for incompleteness and dust extinction. So I've done this myself in the same way, which is often not the case. So this is the sort of Mendel plot that you get. And it's also interesting that the ISO point from Flores et al. Falls consistent with the Cowie point, and the Hughes et al. Point from the submillimeter is quite consistent with the dust-corrected Seidel et al. Point. I think this goes back to the discussion this morning. What I want to point out here is that the burst models trace out a curve with a very similar shape. They don't show this fall-off with redshift that the quiescent models show. So the bursts make a significant difference to the star formation history of the universe. If you break that down into the different contributions from the bursts and the quiescent star formation, here's what you find. Here's the total. Here's the bursts. Here's the quiescent. So you see that at high redshift, the bursts are dominating. At low redshift, there's a crossover at about a redshift of 1. And at low redshift, the quiescent mode is dominating. That's because the merger rate is decreasing, and the amount of gas that's available is also decreasing. So another thing that you'd better check is that you have enough cold gas left over in these galaxies to account for the observations of damp Lyman alpha systems from quasar absorption systems. The data shown here corrected to the lambda CDM omega 0.3 cosmology that I've been using all along. I should have mentioned that. And again, the burst models are shown by this pink line. They seem to have enough cold gas, at least marginally, to be consistent with the observations. The quiescent models have quite a lot of cold gas remaining, perhaps too much. Thank you. And it's also interesting that there was a recent paper by Kaufman and Hennelt, which has already been mentioned several times in the meeting, where they investigate a model which is quite similar to the model that I've been discussing. Here's their Mendel plot. So this is a model in which much of the star formation at high redshift is in these collision-triggered bursts. And they find that this model does very well also at explaining the evolution in the number density of bright quasars with redshift. So this is perhaps a suggestion that a sort of unified picture for the Lyman break galaxies and quasars might be in place. And of course, you can also integrate up all the light from all of these galaxies and ask how much is being absorbed by dust, re-radiated, and calculate the extragalactic background light, which is shown here. This blue curve is the same model, the collisional starburst model that I've been showing you, in which we've assumed now that the dust traces the metals and gas in the galaxies, and the extinction is similar to the extinction in our own Milky Way galaxy. What you find then is that you do produce a significant amount of far infrared background, at least within a few factors of the data. So the top point is the Hauser et al. Data. This is with the Lagasse et al. Correction. If you consider an extreme model in which all of these starbursts are completely extinguished, so they're sort of little ARP220s, you pour all of the light into the dust, you get this yellow curve. So this extreme model would actually overpredict the far IR background. So this suggests that perhaps something in between, where you have heavy extinction but not complete extinction in all starbursts, might work quite well. So of course, another important thing to look at is the clustering of the high redshift galaxies. This is work that's been done by Risa Wexler, which will hopefully be appearing soon. So what she's done is she's taken these semi-analytic models and combined them with n-body simulations. She's put the galaxies inside the halos in an n-body simulation and calculated the correlation function. So this red line shows the fit to the data that Kurt showed earlier at redshift 3. And these blue stars show the correlation function in the collisional starburst model. And as you can see, it fits quite well. So does the quiescent model. And actually, what we find is that this does not discriminate very well between any models that work for the other quantities. So you might think that this would be a strong discriminator between models, but in fact, it doesn't seem to be that powerful, at least once you've restricted yourself to models that reproduce things like the number density of these objects. So another thing you might worry about with the starburst model in particular is that if you have these things popping off all the time, that you would actually get too many close pairs, too many pairs of objects at small separations. So we can look at that using the same technique. The red histogram is, again, data that Kurt provided us with very kindly. And the stars, sorry, now it's changed. The squares are the starburst model. So in the smallest separation bin, you can see that the starburst model does not seem to have any excess of close pairs. And what's really determining this is the number of objects in nearby halos that will be going off simultaneously, combined with the time duration of the burst, which, remember, we calibrated against the hydro simulations. So if I have a few more minutes, two, great, that's perfect. I can address what these objects actually look like. This is Guinevere's question. So again, we have star formation histories for every particle in the hydro simulation. So I'm now going back to the hydro simulations. We can produce images. I know it's backwards. Doesn't really matter. Okay. So we can produce images. So the left side is in the V606 WISTIC band. The right side is in the NICMOS H band. So this corresponds to the rest about 1,500 angstroms and rest about 4,000 angstroms. So here again, you see the sequence of the merger. You see the strong asymmetries that form. You see that you, of course, expect to see objects with lots of substructure and clumpiness. You do expect to see a bit more clumpiness in the rest UV, but you still see significant substructure even in the NICMOS images. I'll just go through this sequence. As the galaxies are separating again, you form these elongated structures, still with significant substructure. Notice also that both galaxies light up. And so that as the galaxies sort of pull apart, you can actually form these structures that are rather larger in radial extent than you might have expected on the face of it. No, these have no dust correction in them. Patrick Johnson's PhD thesis is basically to put dust in these galaxies, which is a very hard problem. And so as time goes on, backwards again, you see this thing settles down into something that looks very boring and perhaps elliptical, like we haven't actually fit any kind of profile to this, but that's certainly something that we plan to do. And we plan to do a quantitative comparison then with the actual images of real high redshift galaxies and see if the morphologies actually look like the real galaxies. It's still backwards there. And I'll stop there.
Questions for Rachel, etc.
Yeah. Okay, so we've used a very simple approach to do that. We simply take a three-component black body, and we fit the temperatures of those three black bodies to match the 12 to 25 and 25 to 60 micron colors from IRAS globally. And then we assume the same spectrum for each galaxy. That's actually wrong in detail, and we're working on doing this better. But for doing the background, it's probably sort of okay.
If you have some sort of global star formation history like that, this is dominated. Well, the question is it dominated by these bursts? I mean, if you integrate up the mass and stars that are formed quiescently and in peaks of greater than a factor of 2 over the quiescent, what fraction is formed?
I showed that.
I saw it. I just wanted.
You want me to show it again?
Well, yeah. It looks like maybe about half the stars are formed in these kind of small bursts. Is that roughly
right? Two-thirds, maybe. I mean, it depends on redshift. So at redshift 3, do I have this right now? I know it's a log plot. At redshift 3, I think it's around two-thirds. This also depends on what you put for your quiescent recipe. So you probably noticed there were lines on the plots that I was not explaining.
Sure.
Those were models with a different recipe for quiescent star formation. And it starts to get down to the details of how you model the quiescent star formation as well.
But so it peaks at this redshift. Quiescent takes over at some point.
That's the point. I mean, that's what's fairly robust, yeah.
I wanted to come back to the remnants of these things because, in principle, you have the answer to a question that I asked Lars, because when he showed us simulations of objects with 10% gas mass, they already ended up with objects that didn't look like elliptical galaxies because they had too high a concentration of stars in the central region, so you end up with a spike in the center. So the question is, when you go to 50 or 90% gas, does this get much worse?
I really wish I could answer that, and you're right that we can answer that, but I just haven't looked at the profiles of these remnants. We're planning to do that. And we can also look at the light profile, which, in principle, of course...
Well, at late times, it will be the same.
At late times, it will be the same in some long wavelength band, sure.
You also didn't say anything about feedback.
Okay, so the feedback is basically turned way down. It's this thermal feedback where you've just put energy into the gas and heated up. It tends to cool off again right away and basically not do very much. So I think that feedback is one of the major uncertainties that could really change this behavior quite dramatically. Just a guess would be that it would tend to smear out those peaks and perhaps make them even broader. But you could imagine a situation where you'd have an initial burst of star formation that would then just kill all subsequent star formation. We really don't know.
So you have feedback zero.
Basically, yeah.
If you propagate in almost feedback zero, with the assumption that you can,
You mean the semi-analytic models?
Well, with all the assumptions you put in for the star formation.
Yes. Yes.
The same.
Well, okay. Let me clarify. In the hydro simulations, the SPH simulations of the colliding galaxies, there is basically no feedback. In the semi-analytic models, there is feedback in sort of the same way that you guys included. Okay. But so the feedback in the effect of feedback in the semi-analytic models is assumed to sort of behave in this same way, whereas you could imagine that in these bursts, feedback might behave differently. That's not been included. Okay?
In the burst models, it looks like when you integrate under the star formation rate curve, that you'd find roughly equal amounts of star formation in the first and the second burst, but they have quite different spectral distributions. The first burst is much more extended.
That's right.
And I'm sort of worried that that wouldn't then look very much like a Lyman break galaxy, which tends to be pretty concentrated.
Well, I mean, I showed you the pictures of the light in the Lyman break galaxies. The half-light radii seem to be fairly consistent. Again, as I mentioned, we're...
Well, they're consistent probably in the second burst, but probably not in the first burst. But
the separation of the two nuclei? It's probably about a kiloparsec, co-moving.
Most of the data is from ground.
Right. You wouldn't resolve that. Yeah, so you have to have HST.